Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group Podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Litigation Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, December 17th, 2019, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members. Welcome to the Federal Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon's topic is titled Trade Secrets Litigation. Do damages awarded in Texas case have broader ramifications? My name is Wesley Hodges, and I'm the Associate Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are very fortunate to have with us Mr. Kurt Levy, who is President of the Committee for Justice, and Ashley Baker, who is Director of Public Policy for the Committee for Justice. After our speakers give their remarks, we will have time for your questions. Thank you very much for sharing with us today. Kurt, I believe the floor is yours to begin.
Thank you. The case that we're discussing today is TitleSource v. House Canary. It was tried in a Texas state court in San Antonio, and it's notable and interesting because of the outrageous verdict involved. I'll get to that in a second, and the larger problem of wild punitive damage awards and the growing problem of trade secret litigation abuse and, you know, other systemic problems that are highlighted by this case. It involves two companies, TitleSource, which now called Amrock, and House Canary. They're both in the real estate appraisal and data market. And originally, they were working together. But that went south, and the result was one of the biggest trade secret cases and largest punitive damage awards on record. In March of last year, the jury awarded House Canary a really jaw-dropping judgment of $705 million in compensatory and punitive damages after accepting wholesale House Canary's claims that Amrock had misappropriated its trade secrets. The case is now on appeal in the Texas Court of Appeals. The technology involved is something called automated valuation models, or AVMs. They're computer models that are often based on AI and are used to appraise property values by analyzing the characteristics of the property, comparable properties, basically like a human appraiser would do. And you may have used this online, you know, Zillow or a website like that to see what the value of your house is. It's a readily available technology. And I got interested in the case, you know, as I say, partly because of the verdict and the growing problem of trade secret litigation abuse, but, you know, also because I built similar AVMs before law school when I was working as a scientist at an AI startup company in California. My job was building AI, or as we called it at the time, neural network models for various domains, mostly financial and military. And that's actually where I got my first exposure to IP before law school. I invented and patented a new technology for explaining the decisions made by these neural network models, which are otherwise black boxes. And being very familiar with the technology, I realized how outrageous the jury's decision had been. I guess I should review the law governing trade secrets. This particular case was litigated under the Texas Uniform Trade Secrets Act. The basis for the Texas law and other state laws is the Uniform Law Commission's Uniform Trade Secrets Act. It's been adopted, I believe, by all but New York and North Carolina. Texas was actually one of the last to adopt it in 2013. There's also a federal statute on this, the Defend Trade Secrets Act of 2016, which was designed to be similar to the Uniform Act. In all of these laws, there's basically three prongs. The claimed trade secret must not be generally known or readily ascertainable through proper means. That should be obvious why that's a prong. The trade secret must have economic value due to its secrecy. It should also be obvious why that's a prong. And then the trade secret holder must use reasonable measures to protect the secrecy of the info. So in other words, the fact that it was misappropriate shouldn't be the fault of the plaintiff. I'll give you a little history of the case. In 2015, Amrock agreed to license an appraisal app that House Canary was developing, but then they strung Amrock along saying, we're working on it. Amrock ultimately filed a breach of contract dispute for $5 million, which, you know, is small change now given how big the case wound up being. And then House Canary countersued, primarily with trade secret claims. And the jury awarded $235 million in compensatory damages, double that to add another $470 million for punitive. And then the court added another $35 million for interest and attorney fees, and you got a total of $740 million. The judge denied Amrock's motions for judgment notwithstanding a verdict and for a new trial. And then as a sort of interesting twist, immediately after judgment, House Canary sued Quicken Loans, which has the same parent as Amrock, in federal court in Texas. So they sued under both the Texas law and the Federal Defend Trade Secrets Act. And the claim there is that Quicken was also responsible for the trade secret theft. That's a real stretch, a real stretch. But the goal there seems to be make sure there's enough pockets or insurance coverage to pay the $740 million or whatever portion of it survives on appeal. There's no trial yet. You know, I will focus my remarks on the state case. What makes this such an outrageous decision by the jury? Well, I think most outrageous or most shocking is that right after the verdict, four whistleblowers, all of whom were former House Canary executives, came forward. And they did so as a matter of conscience, and they told Amrock that the verdict was based on lies and spin, and that House Canary employees had been instructed to lie to Amrock about the app that they were developing and never delivered. And the whistleblower said there are no trade secrets to steal. There's nothing proprietary, let alone anything worth hundreds of millions of dollars. They also disclosed that there had been collusion between an Amrock employee and House Canary management, which promised the Amrock employee a very good job, and they corroborated their testimony with documentation. They all four came to testify at the hearing for a new trial, but, you know, the standard for a new trial is very high, and the judge denied it, giving no reason for denying it. So another outrageous part of it is that, well, to some degree, you'd have to have worked on these things to know how laughable the trade secret claims are, but for one thing, House Canary never provided Amrock with source code or algorithms for the purported trade secrets, so it's just not clear how House Canary could have stolen them, even if it had wanted to. And in fact, because House Canary knew this, they told the jury that Amrock must have gotten the technology through reverse engineering using what it called a, quote, magic machine. That's what they told the jury, and I guess what the jury believed. Like I said, trade secret claims are technical, so if you want the details and why they're laughable, look for an article I had in IP Watchdog a couple of months ago called The Curious Case of the Trade Secrets that Weren't. Also outrageous is just the size of the judgment that bears no relationship to economic reality. It was arrived at just by buying House Canary's claim that, you know, the trade secrets were worth $200 million. They just bought it hook, line, and sinker, and, you know, the $235 was doubled to become $470 in punitive. The whole AVM industry is just worth $70 million a year, and House Canary is just a tiny part of that. So it's just ridiculous that the trade secrets, AVM trade secrets, are worth $200 million. In fact, HC is just a struggling startup. It's not profitable. Its total revenues for all of its products during the period in question, you know, is 1/100 of what they're claiming of the $200 million figure. House Canary may have been dreaming of a bright future, but under Texas law, speculative damage awards are just not permitted. What, again, shocked me most is just, you know, my experience. I mean, you can imagine my surprise when I heard that, you know, House Canary's attorneys had convinced a jury that AVM technology that was, you know, indistinguishable from models that I built 20-plus years ago, you know, had been invented by a company that was founded just 6 years ago. AVMs, again, are publicly available today. They're widespread. I'll go beyond that. They're really, you know, a dime a dozen. You know, there are free ones available online. You know, they're hardly worth millions of dollars. The bottom line is that all the technology for which House Canary claimed trade secrets falls far short of being a trade secret, you know, and or is, you know, something that Amrock had no opportunity or need to steal. Add in, you know, the astronomical judgment here, and this is just, you know, one of the worst jury decisions that, you know, I've ever seen. I think the chances are good in appeal. Having four whistleblowers is quite unusual. There are top-notch attorneys involved on appeal that, you know, should be able to right the wrongs that were done at trial. Trials can be theater, and the counsel for a House Canary, you know, put on a good show, but I don't think they're going to be able to fool an appeals court. So I expect the judgment will, you know, at very least be reduced in court or by settlement. And again, you know, I think this case is, you know, interesting beyond its own details because of the systemic problems that are involved, like wild punitive damage awards. The experts here really weren't qualified in many cases, that is, House Canary's experts, and, you know, were seemingly willing to testify to anything. And it's just really easy, especially for good plaintiff's attorneys, to confuse juries in highly technical IP cases. And last but not least, this is a sign of the growing abuse of trade secrets litigation that threatens innovation, among other things. And I'm going to turn it over to Ashley to discuss just that, trade secret litigation abuse.
Sure. I'm going to take a step back from that a bit and look at kind of the trade secrets law of the past year or two. And you hear a lot, particularly with civil suits, like, oh, this, you know, this settlement, this judgment will lead to a landslide of former litigation. And as we all know, sometimes that's hyperbole, sometimes it's not. In this case, it's really not. There are a couple of factors that really compound that. We see a rise in the number of trade secrets suits across the nation. So this isn't limited to just Texas. In 2018, there was actually a 30% increase in the number of trade secret claims filed. So we see this huge increase in the number of trade secrets claims. We actually see a decrease in the number of patent claims. And there are a few reasons for that, a few reasons for the number of trade secret suits that we kind of get into. And each of those reasons are, one, you see these astronomical settlements, such as the one that we're talking about here in the House Canary and Amrock case. Another is a federal law called the Defend Trade Secret Act, which gives them standing in federal courts as well as state courts. And another is limits on where you can file patent claims. Patent eligibility is another issue. And then just the digitization of, you know, the American economy and workplace mobility in the 21st century is another issue. As of the other large settlements, 69% of the time the jury sides with the plaintiffs in any sort of trade secret case that is settled. Sorry, not that settled, that's where the jury reaches the verdict, which is a pretty large amount, particularly considering that the jury tends to really strongly go one way or another in these cases. As we can see, you know, with this settlement, they very much believe one side and not the other. So in the past year, the top five verdicts were all worth over $100 million. We saw one in California. There was the one involving Waymo, and that was $245 million, which is pretty large, but these are some pretty large companies, which is still a large settlement. And then there was a verdict in another verdict in California that was $223 million. There was a large one in Massachusetts as well. We saw these cases, and they're kind of catching the attention of the plaintiff's bar, because there's a lot of money at stake in this overall. And then, so we have the Defend Trade Secrets Act, which was passed in 2016, which was an attempt to kind of bring some uniformity to state law and make it easier to bring a claim in federal court with a federal civil cause of action for trade secret misappropriation. There was no preemption in that bill, so essentially what it did was you now have standing in both state and federal court, and it defines a trade secret very broadly. It actually defines trade secret as all forms and types of financial, business, scientific, technical, economic, or engineering information, including patterns, plans, compilations, program devices, formulations, designs, prototypes, methods, techniques, processes, procedures, programs, or codes, whether tangible or intangible, and whether or how stored, compiled, or memorialized physically, electronically, graphically, photographically, or in writing. So pretty much anything that you, in their words, go to a reasonable effort to maintain a secret. There's also some litigation now that should decide what is a reasonable effort and what is not. So that's vague as well. So that makes it pretty easy to file a claim under the DTSA. And the number of filings have increased from 900, within 1 year, from 900 cases per year in 2016 to around 1,134 cases like months after. So we already see a sharp rise in litigation following the DTSA, and that's kind of only going up. We'll have to, you know, see where that lands us next year. Also, we have some reforms to IP law that's leading to this as well, particularly limits on where you can file patent claims. There's this U.S. Supreme Court case from 2017 that was the T.C. Hartland case that held that defendants in patent lawsuits may only be sued where they are incorporated or have a physical place of business. So this limited the ability of litigants to pick a more blatant a plaintiff-friendly venue, leading to a shift in where cases are filed. As we know, the Eastern District of Texas was the jurisdiction with the largest patent docket in the country, and it actually had a 72% decrease in new patent lawsuits over the year following the TC Heartland decision. On the other hand, patent lawsuits in the U.S. District Court for the District of Illinois rose by 72%, and the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of California rose by 118%. So essentially, you're seeing in Texas specifically, you see these patent trolls being replaced by what are essentially trade secret trolls in this case. Plaintiffs aren't really benefiting from patent law from patent suits anymore to the extent that they used to, and the damages are a lot larger in these trade secret cases, especially with this case, and that's why this is a particularly dangerous settlement, is if you let this stand, then of course we're going to see a lot of copycat suits. Also, patent eligibility is an issue, particularly following the Supreme Court's decision in Alice. So, I mean, this is a broader problem than how it kind of connects to this case specifically. But owing to trends in patent law, many companies today are opting for trade secret protection instead of patent protection. Applying for a patent means exposing the trade secrets or confidential information anyway. So there's kind of some tension between disclosure for patent purposes and preservation of trade secrets. But it is just generally, with software, it's harder to get patents, and more inventions are considered patent ineligible. More inventions are considered obvious in view of prior art. I mean, it's easier to challenge patent validity. Many patents are eliminated by the USPTO, and many are eliminated through litigation in federal court. So it's also harder to prove patent infringement, and many patent infringement suits are thrown out of court early. So that kind of leads us to more litigation on trade secrets. We also have digitization and workplace mobility. With the digital economy, it's easier to just, you know, walk away from your former employer with, you know, something on a thumb drive, or, you know, email yourself copies of whatever it is on their computer that might be considered a trade secret. So digital evidence is a lot easier to take away, to take with you. And workforce mobility, you know, was a long time ago that you would graduate from college and have, you know, the same career, work for the same employer for 20-something years, and now most people expect to have a new job within the next 2 or 3 years. So if you combine those two factors, that makes it particularly easy to transfer trade secrets. And we also have, particularly over the past year, with the federal state level legislation restricting non-compete or certain covenants. So we see, you know, more people, you know, going from tech company to tech company and taking their data with them. So, like, all of those issues are kind of compound the danger that we see here with this large settlement. It makes it easier for, you know, the plaintiff's bar particularly to see that a lot of money is at stake, and these suits are already on the rise, so it's just accelerating that trend. Kurt, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, I might add, you know, with regard to the mobility of employees, you know, before law school when I was working for the AI startup, but we got a few employees from another company, and the other company immediately sued us for violations of their trade secrets. It was bogus and ultimately didn't succeed, but, you know, that was definitely brought on simply because they, you know, panicked about losing their employees, and I guess they worried that trade secrets would be stolen, but they actually weren't.
It's really easy to do that now. And I know there was another case in Texas last year, which wasn't exactly the same scenario. That does bring to mind the fact that sometimes this litigation, the attorney's fees, really outweighs something that's just kind of a bogus allegation. In this case, I think there was $4 million in actual damages, and 50 times that was the attorney's fees, and that was determined on appeal in Texas. So it's very easy to make those claims.
But trolls, plaintiff's attorneys will find, you know, whatever is the easiest pathway. And with, you know, new restrictions on where patent suits can be filed and it being harder to patent things, I guess it's inevitable that, you know, companies would rely more on trade secrets, but also plaintiff's attorneys would see it more and more as something. I'm sure they wouldn't use the word abuse, but certainly in this and several other cases, they certainly did a good job of fooling the jury.
Well, I think it's symptomatic, too, of a larger problem we have in the United States with software patents and patent eligibility. This wouldn't be nearly as much of a problem if, you know, it were easier to patent software. Also, you know, you have the larger trade war, and you see, you know, in the media, this trade secret's kind of thrown around a lot with Huawei and with China and with Russia, and that's a little bit of a different issue that falls under the Economic Espionage Act. But, you know, if we were able to patent things more easily and also had tighter restrictions maybe on some of these trade issues, then maybe that would solve part of the problem.
I wonder if this is, you know, going to be affected at all by the outcome of the Oracle and Google suit, you know, which is ultimately about patenting software. I mean, technically they're talking about APIs, which are, you know, function calls within software, but it really is about the, if I said patentability, I meant to say copyrightability of software. And I guess if, you know, the result of this lawsuit is to make it harder to copyright software or to make fair use easier, then there's going to be even more reliance on trade secrets, I would imagine. It's not a bad thing. I mean, I believe, and I think you, Ashley, believe too, in strong IP protection. But, you know, when it gets abused, I think it winds up having an adverse effect on people who have real IP to protect.
Well, you mentioned the Oracle case. I mean, I do think that's reading a lot of tea leaves. I mean, the two questions the Supreme Court granted, the first one of the two was just a simple, you know, whether or not software is copyrightable. And that's interesting, though, because that really hasn't been a matter of dispute at all for the past 25 years. Software, of course, is copyrightable.
Google's claim is that because it was the so-called APIs, application programming interface, that it's not copyrightable. But again, that's just another way of saying, well, it's a small chunk of computer code, so it's not copyrightable. I personally don't see the argument there. The fair use argument, you know, might be the more interesting one. But look, the bottom line is, at the end of the day, if Google is allowed to do what it did under copyright, then I would think companies would, you know, try to rely on trade secrets.
Think that's a completely different issue. Coming back to this case, what do you think are the broader, you know, ramifications immediately and in the long term?
Well, you know, this case is getting a lot of publicity, so unfortunately, if the verdict holds up, I think it's going to be a signal to plaintiffs' attorneys everywhere that, you know, it's a lottery worth entering. Like I said, there are systemic problems here that I don't know that we can necessarily address. I mean, the wild punitive damage awards, I mean, there is the, you know, Supreme Court precedent that says that if the punitive damage awards are much larger, you know, 10 times or so the compensatory damage award, that violates due process. That's not the case here, because the compensatory damage awards were $235 million. Of course, if those get reduced, then I'm sure the punitive damage awards will get reduced even without, you know, bringing in Supreme Court precedent and due process. But what can we do about wild punitive damage awards in general? You know, I don't know. I mean, it's in a sense, it's a problem with the jury system, and it's a problem with the fact that it's relatively easy to get qualified as an expert, even if you don't really know what you're talking about. And, you know, people who make a living being experts. I mean, I looked at what a lot of the experts for House Canary testified to, and it's just not true. So, like I said, I don't know if there's any great solutions here. I guess it really just to call, you know, attention to this, to make sure that, you know, courts themselves are educated. You know, I mean, I won't get into the details. I think there's a lot of things, decisions the court made during trial that, you know, could have been handled differently. So perhaps more education is needed for judges as well. Any other thoughts, Ashley?
I mean, I think that's it, except for, I mean, you said it was a problem with the jury system, and I agree with that to some extent. I think really in this case, though, it was less the jury and more so, you know, the evidence the jury was allowed to hear and, you know, the arguments the plaintiffs were really allowed to make that were just completely detached from reality, saying, you know, it, literally that it's a magic machine.
Yeah, exactly.
And,
exactly.
You know, this is kind of a ridiculous case. And like I said at the beginning, this will definitely lead to more lawsuits. And you hear that argument a lot in a lot of civil cases. And here, I mean, I really do think this is kind of the camel's nose under the tent for these sorts of cases, and that we'll definitely see more. You know, it sends a clear message to future litigants that there's a lot of money here at stake.
The court also allowed a lot of prejudicial statements. You know, yeah. House Canary's lawyers kept referring to, you know, send a message to, you know, greedy corporate America. And statements like that, which probably should not, you know, are totally prejudicial and probably should not have been allowed. As you said, you know, it's not just the juries, it's courts as well, and the way the judge handled this. But that's all being pointed out, you know, on appeal. The case has been briefed. We're going to submit an amicus brief, Committee for Justice, that is. I know a bunch of other groups are submitting amicus briefs, and, you know, hopefully things will go better in the Texas Court of Appeals.
Well, very good. Thank you so much, Kurt, and thank you, Ashley. Here's our first caller of the day.
Hi, this is Howard Steele, attorney I do trade secret law in Texas, and it's more of just kind of a little thought. At least in Harris County, only about 0.4% of cases go to trial. And so the fact that that case went to trial in the first place is probably lawyer strategy kind of stuff. And another issue in San Antonio, which is kind of Austin's the same way, there's a circular docket. So like your pretrial motions, you won't have the same judge all the time. So sometimes that causes that problem. So that, you know, I think that might have had some impact on how the outcome kind of went. Everybody just kind of rolled the dice. That was just some thought I wanted to throw out there for you. So it's a little unusual procedural thing there in San Antonio.
Well, you know, the plaintiff's law firm that represented House Canary, you know, if you read their literature, they pride themselves on going to trial. That's how they distinguish themselves from all the other law firms. That, you know, they're aggressive and they go to trials and they don't do a lot of, you know, they pride themselves on not doing a lot of pretrial motions and focusing on the trial. And apparently they're good at trials and appealing to juries.
It sure sounds that way.
I think their site actually says that they prefer not to do discovery. it's pretty direct about that.
When you were bringing up all the facts, I was like, sounds like somebody out-lawyered.
Yeah, you know, that's why I'm looking forward to, you know, the appeals court where, you know, the types of skills that work in front of a jury are not necessarily the skills that work in front of an appeals court.
So, Kurt and Ashley, I do want to turn the mic back to the both of you. Is there anything that you'd like to dive into for more detail or another topic you'd like to discuss?
Just point out again that for anyone who wants to know, you know, what I wasn't able to get into in detail is exactly what the trade secret claims were. Like I said, they were all revolved around these AVMs, but there were, you know, other related things such as the data used to build the AVM and various types of scores that were output by the model. And again, they were all things that I was familiar with from my days in the industry. And, you know, I refuted them all in detail in my article in IP Watchdog. So again, for those people in the audience who want to know more details or who are techies and interested in more of the technical and legal side of this, I do recommend that article.
I would also chime in and say that if you, you know, want to know more about this case or how to get involved or more about trade secrets in general, as it relates to this, as it relates to, you know, trade secrets with China and Huawei or just the digital economy, you can go to our website and read there. You can find our contact information there as well. Our website is committeeforjustice.org.
Yeah, and if there's anyone in the audience who wants to write about this case or file an amicus brief, there's still time to do that. Contact us, and you know we're not coordinating it, but we're happy to talk about what might be good angles to pursue. Because I know I'm worked up about this again, just for the personal reason that I was involved with this before law school. But I hope to see others get involved because I'd like to see justice prevail here.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Kurt and Ashley, and for all the work you do at the Committee for Justice. On behalf of the Federal Society, I'd like to thank you for the benefit of your valuable time and expertise today. We welcome all listener feedback by email. Thank you all for joining us. This call is now adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.